extremely brief review of yesterday, and then we'll go on. We are considering what is called in philosophy the divine command theory. The God's command creates morality. Without God's command, there's no morality. And with God's command, there is morality. His command creates it. When he says do it, it becomes right. When he says don't do it, it becomes wrong. That's what makes it right and wrong. Yesterday, I pointed out two defects in that theory. Number one, there's no good reason to accept it. People who defend it, usually defend it by shifting the burden of argument. They say, well, if you think that it's absolute, you show me what standard you have without God. That's not an argument at all. That's irrelevant. That doesn't show there's no standard. The fact that we don't have one doesn't show that there isn't one. The fact that we haven't found one doesn't show that we can't find one. Such an argument doesn't apply in any area of life. And to shift the burden, say, to the opposite, to the critic, show me what your absolute standard is to simply avoid the question. The critic only says, you have not given me an adequate reason to deny that there's a standard. He's not saying there's adequate reason to say there is a standard. The critic says, I don't know anything. I don't know if there is or isn't. But you say there isn't. Well, I don't hear any good reason for that. So there isn't any good reason to accept the position that without God there's no standard. That was one point. The other point was that according to the divine command theory, when God commands it, that becomes right because he commands it. Now the question is, what is it about God that guarantees that when he says do X, it becomes right? What characteristic of God, what property of God gives his speech that kind of moral authority? So he said, it's not because he's all powerful. Might doesn't make right. Not because he's omniscient. He may know everything, that doesn't say anything about what he says. And as was pointed out by one subtle question, if you tell me that by knowing everything, he knows what's right and wrong, then you've given up the position. Because the position is that until he commands it, it isn't right or wrong. So until he commands it, there's nothing to know. And we said there's only one answer to this question. What is it about God that guarantees his commands create morality? That would be that he's morally perfect. That'll work. God's morally perfect, and he says 2x, then it'll be right to 2x. But again, it contradicts the position. Because you're going to have to start with a premise that God is morally perfect before he commands anything. This position, the divine command position, says that until he commands something, nothing is morally right or wrong. So the second demerit in the theory is that there's no way to explain why it is that God's command makes things right and wrong. Those were the two demerits in the divine command theory we saw yesterday. Any questions occurred to anybody since yesterday? Yeah.
Beginning, we started this off by saying that if you take the side of the critic, you have a good way of criticizing atheism. Why couldn't you just say that instead of taking the side, say that there's no possibility that you can make a standard about that guy, say that he just doesn't have one?
There may be confusion here. What I said was the believer in the divine command theory can criticize the atheist.
Right.
Not the critic. The believer in the divine command theory can criticize the atheist. What he says if you're an atheist, then, what you said, I think the opposite of what you meant. The belief in divine command theory says to the atheist, if you don't believe in God, there is no right or wrong. Now you're suggesting that even from the neutral position, you can criticize the atheist. Yeah. Well, your comment is correct, given what I've told you so far. His comment is, suppose I take the neutral position. I don't know if there's a stand or if there isn't a stand. I'm not going out on a limb. We saw the divine command theory that goes out on a limb, we can chop off the limb behind him and have him fall. Right? So this person is more cautious. Okay, I'm not going to say that there is or there isn't. But one thing's for sure, we don't have one. So, then he suggests, we can say to the atheist, maybe there is and maybe there isn't, but we don't have one. And if we don't have one, then how can you say that the Nazis are evil? Sunday, Monday, you'll have an answer to that too. It is possible for the atheist, without a criterion, yet, to reasonably hold that certain things are right and certain things are wrong. You don't have to have a criterion to hold particular judgments. Having a criterion is a philosophical investigation, and your particular judgments don't wait on that. So I haven't said anything about that yet. Up until where we've come, your comment is quite correct.
What about the argument that says that in the process of creating, God created a particular thing of rule?
Okay, I will talk about that on Sunday Monday, but I'll make a comment about it now. It's surely true that God created everything. And that means, in addition to everything else, he created morality, he created moral rules, and so on. It doesn't follow that his commanding us created the morality. That doesn't follow. He created everything. Different things in different ways. But it doesn't follow that it's the commanding that creates it. The example that I'm going to use at length next week is arithmetic. Did God create arithmetic? Sure, he created everything. So God made it to 7 plus 5 is 12. But if something says 7 plus 5 is 12, you can't challenge him to say, what verse did you learn that from? What mission is it written in? Where's it said in the Midrash? Do you have a place in the Talmud where it says it? No? Well, then I don't think you have any right to say it. No, God created arithmetic, all right, but he didn't create it by commanding us the laws of arithmetic. So there are lots of ways to create things. I'm only considering now the divine command theory, that morality is brought into existence by God's command, and if he hadn't commanded anything, nothing would have been wrong. That's the particular position I'm talking about. This is a tip of an iceberg that we'll chip away at next week as well. All right, so everybody's with me so far? Okay, and today I have a third demerit in the divine command theory, a demerit which, from my point of view, is worse than the first two, and that is the divine command theory is inconsistent with many Jewish sources. Whatever you say about it philosophically, it's wrong Jewishly. And when I say many, I don't mean that there are others that support it. I mean there are others that are irrelevant, but I have many Jewish sources that are inconsistent with the divine command theory and show that it's wrong. And by the way, when people put forward this idea, you never find any footnotes. If somebody puts forward a Jewish idea, an idea that he claims is Jewish, and there are no footnotes, you have a right to be suspicious. We have a big literature. A big literature. Written literature covering 2,000 years. A person states a substantive Jewish principle, and he has no footnotes for it, big question mark. Now, I'll give you a selection of the sources that are inconsistent with the divine command theory. First of all, there are a number of sources that say that a person with his intellect can know things that are right and things that are wrong. A person with his intellect alone can know things that are right and things that are wrong. For example, the Talmud classifies commandments into different categories. The words come from the Torah itself. Chukim, mitzvos, mishpatim, eidos, halachos, there are all sorts of different words. Mishpat, says the Talmud, a mishpat is a mitzvah that you would have known even if God had not commanded. That seems pretty black on white. You would have known this law even if God hadn't commanded it. Sorry?
Were you supposed to know?
The commandments are divided into categories. One category is a category of mishpat.
What is it? Justice.
You mean the translation of mishpat?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I suppose. Sort of. Yeah, something like that. It's hard to translate into English. But the translation isn't what's crucial now. What's crucial is that Talmud tells you here's a category of mitzvot, which, had they not been commanded, you would have known those laws are binding. Maimonides, in the end of the first chapter of his introduction to the Ethics of the Fathers, is describing the different powers of the mind, and one of them is the intellect. And he says, one of the functions of the intellect is to distinguish between appropriate actions and inappropriate actions. And in the Mishnah Torah, in the laws of Tshuva, he reiterates it. He says, man has free will, and man has the ability to know on his own what is good and evil. And he recites a verse in the Torah and gives it a very interesting construal. The verse says, Hein ha'adam ha'ya ka'achad v'menu v'da'as tovera. A typical translation is, behold, man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. To know good and evil. Maimonides suggests that you should put in a comma and read it like this. Hein adam haya kachad, comma, mimena vadas tovara. Behold, man has become unique, comma, not like one of us, but he's become one, individual, unique, comma, mimena vadas tovara, knowing good and evil from himself. And Onkelos translates the verse, in the Aramaic translation, the same way as Maimonides does, and he came a long time before Maimonides. And Maimonides elaborates, this creature, man, has the ability to know from within himself what is good and what is evil. So that's one type of source. Places where it says that man can know on his own what is good and evil.
This is like some kind of self-knowledge inside a person. That's how he feels. That doesn't know good and evil.
Yeah, no one will tell you that man's knowledge is infallible, perfectly clear, perfectly without mistake. No, that's true everywhere. We even make mistakes in arithmetic. I mean, there's nothing where we don't make mistakes. That doesn't mean there's no knowledge. That doesn't mean it's blank. Consider the position that we are examining. The physician says, if God doesn't command, there is no evil, period. Right, just as he said, everything is permitted. Morality is zero until God commands. That's certainly wrong. Maimonides is saying a man has the capacity to know good and evil from himself. It doesn't mean he won't make mistakes. He'll make mistakes in arithmetic also. But it's not zero. The concepts are there. The principles are there. We apply them as best we can. I don't know why we have to go that far, why that comes up. The question is, can you know what is good and what is evil? Even when God tells you, and you know that way, it doesn't mean that everybody does what he knows is right. People don't do everything that God says to do either. Why should acting be part of knowing what's right and wrong? Another type of source is this. A number of authorities say, one of the reasons, this goes back to what I said last night, one of the reasons for keeping the commandments is gratitude. When you reflect on all of the things that God has done for you, Apostle Bubba says this, the Gross says this, Shari Yosha says it. You reflect on all that God has done for you, and you recognize your enormous debt to God, that is a reason for following His commandments. Okay. But that can only be a reason if you agree that when somebody does something to you, you owe him something, and you have an obligation to pay him back. Now, where did that come from? That obligation to repay a debt. Where does that come from? If you tell me that before God commands, there's no morality, there's no right and wrong, there's no good and evil, then gratitude isn't the principle either until God commands. But then if I have to wait for God to command gratitude, I can't use gratitude as a reason for following His commands. If gratitude is a reason for following His commands, I have that gratitude available before He commands. So, those who say that gratitude is a reason for keeping the commandments are clearly presupposing that gratitude is available as an obligation before the commandments. Then you have Abraham. God says to Abraham, I'm going to wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham has a whole defense. And if you look carefully at the text, which I may do with you sometime, you'll see that Abraham's response has two parts. One response is, there may be some righteous people in the city. You can't kill the righteous together with the wicked. Unthinkable. Shall the judge of all the earth not do justice? You can't kill the righteous together with the wicked. And secondly, says Abraham, maybe there are 50 righteous there. If there are 50 righteous there, I would ask you, don't even kill the wicked. Don't even kill the wicked. Have mercy on the wicked. These are two different petitions. One is, don't kill the righteous. According to the first petition, the wicked could go. I'm not talking about that. They're wicked, they deserve to go. But don't kill the righteous. Don't kill the righteous together with the wicked. Don't make the righteous like the wicked as if there were no difference. You can't do that. Because it's unjust. The second claim is, I want to even save the wicked. I would like you to have mercy on the wicked. If they're 50 righteous, please have mercy on the wicked. These are two different claims. But let's examine the first one. Abraham is saying to God, you can't kill the righteous together with the wicked, because if you do so, it will be unjust, wrong, bad, evil, immoral. Why doesn't God say, Abraham, back to philosophy one. You know, you just missed it. You're talking to God. When I say it, that makes it right. I'm the one who creates right and wrong. To say that if I do it, it'll be wrong is a contradiction in terms. If I do it, it's right because I do it. I'm the one who makes things right. That isn't the response. Abraham has not made a simple philosophical error. Abraham is able to say to God, if you do this, it will be wrong. Unjust. Immoral. Well, where is Abraham getting his standards of what is right and wrong, good and evil, just and unjust, and applying them to God? It must be. There's some kind of standards outside God that he's applying here. Good. Let's see if any.
Why can't you say he's pitting God against God?
Oh.
Yeah.
That's the obvious objection.
Question.
Why can't you say that Abraham learned his standards of justice from God and is just quoting God against himself? Look, you said these are the principles and now you're violating it, right? Many years ago, when I first came, I think, I made this argument, and one of the students said that. I was stunned. It was a terrific, terrific reply. You can imagine, since then I thought of the answer. The answer is this. When you say to God, look, you're on record that this is justice. And this contradicts your principle of justice. According to the theory we are considering, there's no reason for God not to respond, so. So I'm violating my own principle. So what? Why shouldn't I violate my principles? Just because I said so then, I have to live up to it now. Why should I have to do that? You think it's immoral to violate your own principles? Oh, oh, that's what we were talking about. You have to bring in from the outside a kind of principle of moral consistency. Then I want to know where that came from.
I never had a principle of moral consistency. When you say it, it's lost in the past forever.
So he said it. Why can't he violate it after he said it? Because it's nasty to do that, huh? If you say something, you ought to live up to it. That's itself a moral consideration. Why can't God say, I'm creating it as I go along, you know, when I do it, it's right? In this case, saying it and then violating it is right because I'm doing it. What took me a little while to figure this out was to make clear in my mind not to confuse logical inconsistency with moral inconsistency. I'll explain a little bit what I mean. If a person says, avocados are green. And then later he says, avocados are pink. Something's gone wrong because they can't both be right. Something he said is false. Because it's a logical contradiction. If he's supposed to be infallible and all-knowing, perfect in various ways, it'll be a puzzle how he said something that's wrong. But if a person says, I promise never to eat avocados, and later he eats avocados, he hasn't committed any logical contradiction. He's just not living up to his word. What kind of failure is that? That's a moral failure. You said you would, and now you're not doing it? That's a moral failure. So to criticize him, you have to have standards of morality. Logical contradiction is built into the way you think. There's no way to avoid criticism for a logical contradiction. A moral contradiction where you don't live up to your own word, moral contradiction like that requires moral standards to criticize. So God says, here's my definition of justice. And later, God does something which violates that definition, and you're going to criticize God as Abraham does. You can't do that on the basis of logic. There's no logical contradiction here. There's a moral failure. You have standards, you're not living up to them. Okay, then to criticize him, you have to have moral standards. And according to the divine command theory, God creates moral standards. They are only standards because he creates them. So he'll say, saying it then, doing this now, is my standard. You'll have no way to criticize. So again, you have to stand outside and be able to criticize God with standards that are independent of what he says.
Because whenever he says something, he creates a new standard.
It isn't a new standard. This becomes a further articulation of the standard. Right? I said this is just, and now I do this on another occasion. Saying that and doing this altogether must be right because I'm making it. It's mine. I'm the one who makes things right.
And even if they don't lodge the contradiction, we're not talking about logical things. We're talking about
this is a moral failure. But then to criticize, you have to have standards of morality with which you can criticize. That means you have morality standing outside. Yeah.
What does it understand a morally perfect being to be a being that is morally consistent?
Correct. That gives up the position we're considering. Don't forget, we're talking about the divine command theory, right? Before he says anything, you can't call him morally perfect. That's one of the criticisms of the theory. Yeah.
The reason why the divine command theory doesn't work is because Abraham's answer to God wouldn't make sense. Now,
His claim against God would be a simple philosophical mistake.
Now, technically, you can take the other side. God can have
Sorry, according to which other side?
The side that's not, that if it's not mine, you can come to a morality.
Right.
What? Why would God have to follow what Abraham thinks?
It's not that he has to follow what Abraham thinks. What Abraham thinks is true.
I think God says not.
Oh, it could be that Abraham's making a mistake. But in this case, it clearly is not that. It's clearly not a mistake, right? It's talking about killing righteous people. So, if Abraham's thought is a true thought, then God, in his perfection, is going to be morally perfect. He's going to live up to it. Now, this explanation of Abraham leads to another application of the same idea, which is a gigantic application. This is the last point that I have to make on the basis of traditional sources. They contradicted the divine command theory. Yeah.
The answer is that God thought he could do whatever he wants, so he declares and he made the rules and he said so, then he said that it's right, and it's right.
That's what...
He can't answer anything. Like, he can't question God with anything, because he's God, he makes whatever he says is right.
So well, that's... Correct. That's the liability of the divine command theory.
So, like, what's the point of philosophy of religion? There is no... If you say God does. So you can't question anything.
Well,
God's God.
Yeah, but philosophy doesn't only question. Philosophy also explains. And you could use philosophy to explain inside what's going on. Philosophy has a lot of uses. But you're right, you couldn't question it. That's quite true.
And that's like a land answer. Like, if nothing else works, you say
God's
God.
Right, so I'm rejecting that, you understand? I'm rejecting that. What you're expecting now is the divine command theory. I'm rejecting the divine command theory. I'm not taking that position. I'm rejecting it. Now, this explanation of Abraham leads to another application of the same point. You know that there's a problem of evil. Sometimes in life, in thought, you can learn great lessons from a problem, even if you don't get to the solution. If you just meditate on the problem, you can learn great lessons. What I want to do now is introduce you to the problem of evil, how to understand it, and what we can learn from the problem. I'm not interested in the solution. The problem has solutions. One of them is found in a chapter in a book I wrote called The Informed Soul, of which there are copies upstairs. There are many books written on the subject. I'm not interested in the solution. I'm interested in meditating on the problem. Let's see how the problem works. There's evil in the world. Well, how come? After all, God is omniscient. He knows about it. God is omnipotent. He can certainly do something about it. And God is morally perfect, so he ought to do something about it. So how come there's evil? I don't want a solution. I want to meditate on the problem. So I said, forget solutions. I'm not interested in solutions. I want to understand what the problem says.
But the answer is...
Forget the answer. I'm not interested in the answer. I haven't yet finished. I want to show you what the problem says and what we can derive from the problem. Just leave solutions alone. That's for another occasion. So, what are we saying? If God knows everything, is all-powerful, and is morally perfect, then... there shouldn't be evil. Shouldn't be. Can't be. But there is evil. So if there is evil, turn it around. Then, either he's not all powerful, or he's not all knowing, or he's not morally perfect. Now, that is what I'm saying. I'll do it again. Here's how the problem is set up. Since God knows everything, he knows about the evil. Since he's powerful, he can stop it. Since he's morally perfect, he ought to stop it. Take the three together. It seems there shouldn't be any evil. And yet there is evil. Contradiction. What does the contradiction mean? It means, if I just turn it around, since there is evil, then either God doesn't know about it, or God's not powerful enough to do anything about it, like that fellow said in that disastrous book, bad things happen to good people. Or the third option is that he's not morally perfect. That's what's going to follow from the existence of evil. That's the problem. Because there's evil, it seems that either God is not all-knowing, or not all-powerful, or not morally perfect. Yes?
The only reason we see that there's evil is that based on our initial knowledge without God's command, you know, like our inherent knowledge of what good and evil is, we can see what evil is.
Good. Very good. Very good. I think that's right. And I'm going to take it a step further, but I think you're right. Number one, the problem gets off the ground because we can identify evil. If we couldn't identify evil, the problem couldn't even get off the ground.
Yeah.
Who says there isn't evil? Who says what you call the evil is really evil? Quite right. I think that's quite right. But here, possibly, we can make a move like his. I'm only saying it's evil because God defined it as evil. I look around and I see it. At that level, I don't go any further. I get around it his way. But to turn around and say, listen, God, there's evil in the world, and since there's evil in the world, if you know about it, and you could stop it, and you don't, then you are immoral. That's what the problem of evil says. There's evil in the world, if you know about it, and you could stop it, and you don't, then it's a moral failure in you. The problem of evil is a hypothetical moral judgment against God. Listen again. The problem of evil is a hypothetical moral judgment against God. If there's evil, and if you know about it, and if you're powerful enough to stop it, and you don't, then you are not perfectly moral. You have moral failings. Now, of course, the solution will be that because of its consequences, or because of its nature, or because of its interactions, or because of the people, it isn't really evil. Okay, very good. Or it's really evil, but there's a justification for why God does it. That's all another subject, how we solve it. But look at the problem. The problem says, since there is evil, if you know about it, and if you're powerful enough to stop it, and you don't, then you are a moral failure. That means the problem says I'm passing moral judgment on God. Now, the literature on this problem goes back to the book of Job, which was written by, was the author of the book of Job? No. Nobody said that. The author of the book of Job is? Moses. Moses. No, my focus is whether it's a novel or whether it's a true story. It's not my focus who wrote it. As far as I know. Let's back to Moses. To the present day, whenever the problem of evil is raised, no one, I have done a reasonable search of the literature, maybe there's something out there that I haven't seen, but no one says, oh, it's no problem, because you're trying to pass judgment on God. You can't do that. God makes up standards. He's the one who creates the standards. So when he does it, it's good by definition. No one takes that approach. There are dozens of solutions to the problem of evil. None of them says, it's a pseudo problem. You made it. It's an elementary philosophical error. You can't pass judgment on God. Nobody says that. And nobody says we don't know what evil is either. No one says that. For reasons that I mentioned the other day. No one says we don't know what evil is. That's not a solution that anybody uses. No, they take it very seriously. They say that the bad things that happen contribute to good ends. That's what that they will be means for, and therefore they're justified. Solutions like that. So from the nature of the problem, in the problem, you are passing moral judgment on God. Well, in order to pass moral judgment on God, you have to have standards. You have to have standards that you can use to do that with. And those standards are going to come from someplace else, not coming from God's command. So, in my view, there's just no hope for this. You with me? These are the Jewish sources. I'll give you one more. This is sort of radical. But Nissim Gaon, in his introduction to the Talmud, says there are certain commandments that are based on logic, and these commandments are binding on non-Jews as well as Jews. The non-Jewish responsibilities are not limited to the so-called seven laws of the children of Noah, or the seven categories of laws of the children of Noah. No, those are the ones that are revealed. But in addition to them, there are logical laws. And logical laws are binding on everybody, because everybody has an obligation to be logical. They're binding on non-Jews as well. Without revelation. So you have a raft of sources, Jewish sources, telling you that there can be laws that are binding without God's command. No, first of all, he did tell it to them. He told them. Six out of the seven were binding on Adam. Of course, he knew it and passed it down to his children. The seventh was commanded to Noah explicitly, and he passed it down to Israel, was told to them. And some of them, I don't think you could discover with logic. So, therefore, you, it's not going to be exhausted that way. Yeah.
So, if we have our own standards, why do we need the Torah?
Oh, good question. Excellent question. If we have our own standards, then is the Torah somehow divorced from morality? Not related to morality? It's like a different realm altogether? Now, you know, you could have your sense of right and wrong. When you get married, you have all sorts of elements in your relationship when you are married. Excuse me. You know from experience when I say that. And you have, there are all sorts of elements in your relationship with your wife which are not part of general morality, they're because of what has happened and things that are happening and plans and commitments and so on and so on. So that's going to give a lot more content to your life than just morality. So you could say, what is religion for? Religion is for like marriage. So it creates a whole context in which things are done and interactions take place and possibilities exist and so on and so on. What bothers me along the same line is, even if it has a use, has a place, but will religion be totally divorced from morality? Will religion have no input into morality? That seems very extravagant. Why? To say that they're totally divorced realms, we do take God's commands very seriously. Take God's commands very seriously. It seems that they should have some kind of moral force. And if we have, as you say, if we have our own standards of morality, we have our own understanding of right and wrong, how then can religion play any moral role? That's the question that's left over, and that's the question which I'm going to discuss in detail this week. Yeah.
I think my question is kind of the reverse.
Okay.
But do we have any responsibility to pure morality or only morality that coincides with the Torah?
Do we have any responsibility to pure morality or do we have any responsibility to pure morality, or only morality that appears in Torah or somehow is the result of Torah? Very, very often, in Jewish philosophy, when it looks like you're confronted with A or B, the answer will be both. The answer to your question is both. Let's see how or why. But the answer to your question is both. We have a responsibility to pure morality, and we only have responsibility to morality within Torah. Focus. Let's see how they're related. That's the crucial job, to see how our sense of right and wrong, which is independent of the Torah, that's right, independent of the Torah, independent of God's command, then relates to all of God's commands. So you're right to ask, does it sit outside? Does it not sit outside? And I say, it sits outside, and it doesn't sit outside. Oh, yeah.
I may have mentioned this before, but if God created man or his system, then he also created the morals that are inherent morals before commanding.
Yes.
Morals. So, in that sense, commanding also by putting them in a system.
Well, I call it a command, right? But remember the position that we were considering. Here's Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky says, if there is no God, then everything is permitted. Now, if there is no God, where? In my world, in which people are talking and between business and robbing and stealing and giving charity and courts of justice, in my world, there's no right or wrong. If God hasn't decreed it. If God created the world and gave us this sense without his commanding anything, then it's there, and he created it, and his command is not necessary. As I said before, the case with arithmetic. 7 plus 5 is 12. Even if he never reveals that, and even if he never commands it, it is 12 anyhow. I don't need God's command, his revelation, to back up 7 plus 5 is 12. Yeah.
The fact that set up a label says to God that he's doing something that is that a logical conclusion that if he created morality, that he's bound by that he creates it?
No. It isn't from there. It's from the fact of his perfection. Perfection includes moral perfection.
So it's nothing to do with the fact that he created morality and therefore he has to be moral.
No, I mean, he created space and time. That doesn't mean he has to be subject to space and time.
So because he's perfect?
This aspect of his creation is a reflection of his own inherent nature. Whereas space and time are not reflections of his own inherent nature. It's the same question.
So that's a gift.
That's right. That's part of perfection. Perfection includes moral perfection. Being that had some element of evil couldn't possibly be perfect. Okay, what else can I tell you without letting the cat out of the bag? Yes, you could. That's pretty much the direction which I'm going to go. The truth is, the direction which I'm going to go, I said already twice this week. Yeah, I said it last night in a certain way, I said it earlier this week, but I can just put in these terms, so it isn't a totally unfamiliar idea, but I'll elaborate on it a bit more like tomorrow, Sunday, Monday. Let me just recall an idea I said yesterday briefly. I'm very pleased that nobody asked me to define morality. Gosh, you know, if you have the definition itch, define your terms. Tell me what you mean. That would have been a good place to scratch. You know. Morality, boy, that's a tough one. In fact, along with a bunch of other interesting terms like truth and knowledge and belief and reality and existence, I don't know any except the definition for morality. But we don't need a definition. All we need to know is that morality is the area in which you make judgments using a certain vocabulary. Right, wrong, good, evil, just, unjust, permissible, forbidden. It's that area. Without an abstract definition, I know what area I'm talking about, what area I'm trying to deal with. After all, the word morality isn't a blank in English. When you use the word, people manage to communicate with it. Yes, there are some times when there's miscommunication, but very often there's a matter of solid communication with it. You don't have to have an abstract definition in order to be able to communicate in most circumstances if you're just careful how you do it. So, here also, we're talking now about matters of right and wrong, good and evil, justice, and similar matters, how they are related to the commandments of the Torah, the revelation of the Torah. and we have come to the conclusion that we have external standards, and then we have to see how the Torah fits into those external standards. Okay.